with a person in a management position makes it safe to acknowledge reality, well, then they're going to get more of the full story from their direct reports. But if they make it unsafe to acknowledge reality, don't be surprised when you find out about something way later than you should have.
Welcome to Scaling Software Teams, a weekly podcast to help software leaders navigate fast growth without losing the magic that made that growth possible. I'm your host, Wes Winham. Today, I'm joined by Max Yoder. Max is the founder and CEO of Lessonly, a team learning and training software company. Lessonly raised an $8 million Series B in late 2017, and they have around 15 engineers. Max's team is dedicated to helping people do better work, which is where he got the title of his new book, Do Better Work: Finding Clarity, Camaraderie, and Progress in Work and Life. In this episode, we talk about the nuts and bolts of being a team leader. Great leaders achieve results through others, and that requires understanding emotions. We cover vulnerability, sharing work before you're ready, and why leaders don't always know the answer. And that's a good thing. I just cannot recommend Max's book enough. It's 100 pages packed full of concrete steps to be a better teammate and a better leader. We're going to link to Max's book in the show notes, and we'll also link to Max's weekly email note. And now, here's my conversation with Max Yoder, CEO of Lessonly. Max Yoder, thanks so much for joining us today on Scaling Software Teams.
Wes, it's my pleasure.
One of the concepts from your book that I resonated with me is about sharing before you're ready. So in the software world, it's put a prototype out there, put it in front of a user, get a review, a pull request early. I think that's becoming really common practice. How to share with before you're ready, interact with the work that we do as knowledge workers.
Yeah, we all have such a limited perspective. We all have such a limited vantage point. And it's not that we can't come to good ideas in the vacuum of our minds. It's that we can only see so much in the vacuum of our minds. And if we very quickly, 30 to 60 minutes into whatever the initiative or the project we're working on, we get in front of some folks who ultimately depend on that initiative being a success. And we say, what am I missing? What's working? What isn't working? What should I add? That the same stuff that I've mentioned already. We can start to see new angles. And whether those angles are good ones or not isn't the point. It's that we should at least see if there's good ones out there that we're missing. And sometimes there will be, and sometimes there won't be. It also just builds a tremendous amount of trust between teammates that, I value your opinion and I go out there and ask for it. But I think knowledge workers need to do this because there's not a single answer. This isn't a mathematics where there's just one result. There could be a bunch of different ways to deliver a final product. And when we go out and share before we're ready, I think we get much more closer to delivering a good final product than if we try to stay in the vacuum of our minds and do it all by ourselves.
What do I do with the feeling that I'm going to show something that's going to be bad? I haven't spent very much time on it. How do I deal with that when I'm thinking about sharing before I'm ready?
The same way that if you're a designer designing a product, the same way that you'd want to keep something in maybe a tool that makes things look low fidelity and kind of sketched out so that you don't make somebody anxious about saying, oh, this is bad and I can tell you've been working on it a long time, but I don't want to tell you that it's bad because I can tell you've been working on it for a long time. Coming to somebody and saying, hey, I've been doing this for 30 minutes. I know I'm missing some things. This is me sharing before I'm ready. Setting that tone and that precedent that invites the feedback that says, you're doing me a favor right now if you give me your two cents. You're not kind of blowing up a project I've been working on for 3 months. So I think it's just all about expectation setting, walking up to somebody and saying, I could really use your help to figure out what I'm missing because I want to nail this. And it's really important to me that if you tell me what I'm missing or what I should be adding, that it's going to help me. And just setting that precedent with folks.
What part of transitioning to a manager is maybe producing fewer artifacts sometimes. And I'm not shipping code anymore. I'm not producing mock-ups. How do I share those more intangible, those decisions that I'm making before I'm ready as a manager? What are some things that work for you?
Yeah, I tend to try in small little groups things that I'm thinking about doing in big groups. So if I bring somebody in, I might preview an idea with them and just say, how does that hit you? just the same way I do it if I was on a project. It might take a lot longer for it to come out and be in front of the rest of the team, but I think it's just trying it in small pockets. You know, it's the same iteration. And you're right, we don't have these deliverables. The more we manage, the more we have kind of these daily deliverables. I really struggle with that. I don't know about you, Wes, but that was hard for me to kind of get off that dopamine train of like being able to check 5 boxes a day and say, oh, I've done a good job because I checked those 5 boxes. And I say dopamine train because I think we get this positive feeling. It's either serotonin or dopamine or whatever it is that of completing something. And I had to, I still have to work really hard at not kind of going back in and trying to find these really quick wins that don't ultimately add up to the job I need to be doing.
I think that's a really common struggle, especially for developers, where that dopamine hit is even faster. When you're doing unit tests and a test goes from red to green, you can get that multiple times an hour. To a manager, it's just slower. It's really hard.
It's like retraining your brain, right? And it takes a long time.
I've heard Charity Majors, who's going to be on the podcast, she talks about this. It takes 2 years. You are changing your brain. Whenever you become a manager, you need to sign up for 2 years because you really are rewiring your reward structure.
And I love that.
You sign up for less, you're just going to be halfway, and you're going to get most of the pain without a lot of rewiring and gain, which sounds about like my career. The first 2 years were the roughest.
It's so helpful though to have that context, right? It's kind of, you know, I don't know if you ever have read any of Amazon's kind of shareholder letters where Jeff Bezos talks about a friend who wanted to master the perfect handstand and set their own benchmark for when they should be able to get it done. And I think they thought they'd be able to get it done in, you know, some number of weeks. And of course, they weren't able to do the perfect handstand in that number of weeks. So they went out and hired a handstand coach, and the handstand coach was like, 6 months it's going to take you to nail this of daily progress. And that person just had kind of set themselves up to think a certain number of weeks, and they had nothing to base that on. They just said, well, I should be able to do this in a certain period of time. So it's super helpful for you to share that. And I'm really excited to hear that podcast, because I think we all need to know how long it takes so that we're not making fake goals for ourselves that just aren't achievable and are going to cause us to be disappointed.
Speaking of maybe being disappointed and disappointing people sometimes, one of the big themes in your book is vulnerability. Can you talk to us about why vulnerability is important as a leader?
Yeah, so I think what we get when we're vulnerable is we model the behavior that we need to see from our teammates. So a leader that maybe isn't vulnerable would be somebody who kind of puts on airs that they have all the answers, they know the way, and they dominate life. So they're generally not wrong, you know. Even if they're wrong all the time, they would generally posture as though they kind of know exactly what they're doing. Well, every time a manager does that, they need to understand they're modeling the behavior that their teammates are then going to emulate. So everybody who reports to that manager is now going to posture as though they also have the answer and dominate life and know the way. And that's incredibly dangerous, because what you'll do is start distorting reality. You as the manager will start to not actually get the full picture of reality, because your teammates will start hiding it from you, because inevitably something will go wrong for somebody who is posturing. And it's going to be difficult for them to raise their hand and say, I made a mistake, because the manager themselves has not made it safe to say I made a mistake, because the manager themselves has not ever raised their hand and said, I've also made mistakes, and you're going to make mistakes, and it's okay, because we're not perfect. You know, we have gaps in our armor. That's what vulnerability is. You know, it's knowing that you have gaps in your armor, that you're not capable of doing everything, that you're going to need help, that you're going to be scared. So when a person in a management position makes it safe to acknowledge reality, well, then they're going to get more of the full story from their direct reports. But if they make it unsafe to acknowledge reality, don't be surprised when you find out about something way later than you should have, and it's too late to do anything about it because your team kept it from you.
If I'm telling my team that I don't know things, are they going to lose respect for me? I'm the leader. Aren't I supposed to have the answers?
Yeah, I think that's, you just got to kind of rewire their expectations in that case, because that's just a false premise. And I write about it in chapter 2 of the book, which is Share Before You're Ready. I talk about how there's this myth that leaders know the answer. And I learned that over, you know, 7 years of Lessonly, as I became a manager and as people around me became managers, the nervousness of not knowing what to do. But then realizing that, oh my gosh, nobody knows what to do. You know, we're paving new territory here. It's not that I never know what to do. It's that a lot of the time it's new territory. So the myth of leaders know the answer needs to be shifted to the reality that leaders learn the answer. And I think, you know, if you're nervous about teammates walking out the door because you're exposing the fact that you're a real human, first and foremost, I think they're going to respond differently. I think they're going to respond and say, well, that's pretty cool. because that's not that kind of, it jukes my expectations in a positive way. And then I also think that you can kind of let them know that they need to understand that leaders learn the answer, and that's what you expect of yourself, and that's what you expect of them. You expect them to ask questions if they're unsure. You expect them to talk about it if they need help, and ultimately that's going to make it safe for them to do so. So I doubt people will run. I think they'll probably be appreciative, because you'll be again acknowledging reality. The reality we all know is there, right, Wes? You and I both know that we got a lot to do. We have a lot of learning to do. And everybody else is the same way.
I thought everyone knew, thought I always knew the answer. If I just pretend, they won't know I'm imperfect, Max. That's my whole plan here.
Oh, yeah. I know that you're teeing me up. But, it's the thing that people really do believe that. Whether they mock it kind of in reality or not, and I know you're not actually doing that, but if they go, well, of course, that's obvious, well, just watch their behavior, because their behavior doesn't make it look obvious. You know, their behavior is contradictory to this idea that, well, of course, leaders have to learn the answer. It's not always the behavior doesn't always reflect that. Sometimes it reflects that they think they should know the answer. So I think we all need to be models for this, and we all need to keep saying it out loud, even if people kind of intuitively get it. We need to keep giving more and more examples.
Could you share a story of a time whenever you've been vulnerable when it was hard?
So one of the first things I do with teammates, every month we have our new hires get together, and I just kind of share the background of Wes and Lee. And the main idea of that engagement is for me to say, I'm assuming you want to know why Wes and Lee exists. I'm assuming you want to know what we're after and what we're aiming for. And so I just spend that time answering questions. If they say, yes, Max, I do want to know why Wes and Lee exists. Yes, I do want to know what we're aiming for. I tell them. Oftentimes people ask, why'd you start the business? And I give them a background on the fear that motivated the business getting started. I mean, I was motivated by irrational fear that I needed to be some superhero for my family. My family didn't need me to be a superhero, but I made up a story in my head that if I needed to save my family from any kind of catastrophic issues that might hit them, that I didn't know if they were prepared for or not. It's not a great call to start a business in order to do that. You and I both know that. It's just not a great call, but I was a young man who didn't know any better. And by telling the story of, struggles that I felt as a member of my family and fear that I had, immediately after, I tend to get one or two people from that group of new hires who come and they say, I had something going on in my family I'd love to talk to you about sometime. They open up to me. To me, that's not difficult because I've been doing it for a long time. You know, it comes naturally to me now to be vulnerable. And I see the positivity that comes from it. And I see the beauty of it. I see how it liberates people. But I think there was a time when I would have been a lot more uncomfortable sharing that story. But now I've seen so many times how helpful it can be.
I think it's easy to imagine what that conversation should be like about how you saw the future. And as a result, you are continually crushing it.
Not the case. Not the case, yeah.
does not create an environment where we're comfortable saying, I'm not crushing it right now, or I think I might not be crushing it next month unless I get some help.
I share stories about my wife too. Sorry to cut you off. Like that are more modern, right? Like this isn't just like I had struggles when we started, Leslie. It's here's things I'm not doing as well at home. And has anybody ever, can you relate to that? I'll ask teammates. And it's just, there's a lot, it's all really relatable. You know, that's the humanity in all of us. But it's just about doing it in a genuine way. You know, like if it's not a genuine demonstration of vulnerability to you, don't do it, because it'll come off as disingenuous. And, if you're not comfortable with vulnerability, doing it in a place with people you really trust, first and foremost, is a great it's a great place to start. You might not be comfortable doing it at work. I want you to be. But if you're more comfortable doing it with, so your significant other or a family member, start there and you'll start to see the benefits and they'll start to snowball.
I like that. Start in a safer place and you can see the benefits, get the feedback, and try it bigger and bigger.
You bet.
How is emotion like a pipe?
One of my favorite parts of the book is in the first chapter, I talk about being vulnerable, and I quote Dr. Jill Bolte Taylor, who's a neuroanatomist who made waves by having a stroke and then coming back from that stroke as somebody who knows a lot about the brain. So she had to kind of rebuild her brain as a neuroanatomist, and then she did a TED Talk on it and it blew up and she went on Oprah and her book became this bestseller. Well, I'm just lucky enough that she happens to be my mother-in-law's best friend. So I got to spend some time with her, and I got to invite her to Yellow Ship, which is our annual user conference at Lesson Lee. And she came to our first one and talked about building a better brain and basically reminding us how much power we have over our emotions and our brain. And she talked about how she views emotions and our processing of them like a pipe. And she said, imagine a pipe where emotions either flow through like water if you're processing them, or they get built up and stuck if you don't process them. Over time, if you don't process your emotions, the pipe can only handle so much of that water getting built up in it. So it'll either burst, or you'll feel such an unease that you'll try to tamp it back down, the water back down with maybe drugs or alcohol or any other addictive behavior, you know, social media, retail therapy. So she's like, I view it like a pipe. If you don't process your emotions, they don't go away. They build up in the pipe. And you see, you know, we all struggle with this, where one day we just kind of have a breakdown, or one day we have an outburst. And we're like, where did that come from? Well, it came from the fact that we didn't process our emotions. So she is a big, big, big fan of processing emotions. And she's not alone in that. You know, that's a very good thing for all of our psyches. And I don't think we've ever really, we learned how to do it. I don't know about you, but I think our parents' generation, Wes, didn't learn how to do it. They weren't taught how to do it. Social and emotional learning wasn't a thing. And our grandparents, you know, same boat. It's not that nobody learned how to do it, but I think the rule was we were undereducated about social and emotional learning. And I'd like to see that change.
One of my co-founders, he consistently, if we're in a meeting and it's a hard meeting and we're having, you know, we're disagreeing about something, I know he'll say, I really didn't sleep very well last night, so I think I might be having trouble with this. Or I'm feeling kind of defensive right now. Give me a moment. Like he shares, creates visibility and legibility into his emotions. And I'm like, I'm trying really hard to copy that because it just seems magical. Have you seen, do you work with people that do that sort of thing? Is that helping process, or am I talking about something else?
Yeah, I think ultimately that is a really good way of helping people understand where you're at, so that they don't read into where you're at in maybe a way that you don't need them to. Maybe, you know, when somebody says, "Hey, I didn't sleep very well, so I might come off as a little agitated," it doesn't give them excuse to be a jerk, right? But it does help you understand that if they're being quiet, it's maybe not you. And if they don't say that out loud, you might read into it and say, did I frustrate this person? You know, we can all create these really, really wild narratives in our head about why something's happening. So I really respect your co-founder for doing that, and for using that not as a weapon, but as a way to just, you know, show people reality. I didn't sleep well, or I'm frustrated, and it doesn't have to do with you all. And I don't want you to read into it and misconstrue it. That is an element of, I think, acknowledging emotions, but I think processing emotions, and again, a psychologist is the best person to weigh in on this, is kind of understanding, going back and thinking through an emotion and saying, you know, how did I feel when it happened? What good came out of it? What really frustrated me about it? What really upset me about it? You can talk through that. I wouldn't do it in the middle of a group meeting, and I know you're not suggesting as much. But you know, you can talk. You can go on a walk with me, or go on a walk with Wes, or just go out on a walk with your significant other, or your friend, or your family member, or go talk to a counselor or a therapist, and just have somebody help you see new angles. Because the reason that when I think about processing, it's expanding maybe your limited vantage point to see more of what's happening. We tell ourselves a lot of stories, and those stories are generally uninformed. And sometimes they go very negative, and other people can help us see that maybe we're telling ourselves stories that are needlessly negative, or not true reflections of reality.
That sparked a thought. How do you, I feel like one of my, maybe my biggest job is to change my mind about things I used to believe really strongly. It's to believe things strongly and then change my mind. So your comment about processing emotions, it feels like that's often what I'm doing. How do you change your mind?
How do I change my mind? So in a general sense of just like when I learn a new fact?
So there are things about Lesson Lee that you used to believe strongly that I guarantee are wrong, like fundamental beliefs about how you're going to market, how you're going to build a product. How do you come around to the new reality?
Yeah, I think I'm blessed with a lack of conviction, where I just want to do the best thing for the team. The main thing I need to do is surround myself with people who see things differently than me. And if I have an opinion on something, state it, but, you know, not hold it too strongly. I want us all to be builders of this business. So it's not my job to kind of say, here's exactly what we need to do. It's my job maybe to pose the questions that maybe otherwise wouldn't be posed, and then to be a participant in the discussion. The beautiful thing about Lesson Lee is I don't know what to do, and it really helps me and other people come up with good ideas. And when they come up with good ideas, yeah, it's just a tremendous benefit for me. I think I'm fortunate not to walk into things and feel like I have something to prove with my intellect. I don't have anything to prove with my intellect. I think people, you know, I'm blessed that people appreciate me as a teammate, whether I contribute that day or not. And I think that's just something that, you know, a little bit of self-compassion and time giving me the ability to kind of put my ego aside and say, my ego is the thing that's going to sink this ship. If anything's going to sink this ship, it's my ego. So how do I let that just be set aside? And how do I set an example that I want everybody else to set, which is, it doesn't matter if I'm right or wrong. It matters if we make a good call. And I believe that. Now, there are things that that if you came to me and said, hey, Wes here, I think we should change and go this direction. If I've got good intel, or if I've got good experience that suggests that you're incorrect, I'm not going to say, you know what, Wes, let's do that. I'm going to say, Wes, you know, what do you base that on? And I'm going to listen, but my experience has taught me a lot about, you know, what training software should and should not do. And if you're telling me something that it should do that I've seen is just contrary to the evidence, I'm not just going to go with the flow. That makes sense?
I think so. I think my struggle is that second thing you said, I know about training software. I have evidence. I feel like I'm maybe too good sometimes of convincing myself of that when I know it's not true. One of my co-founders, we were talking about, does everybody in the company need to be a missionary, or is there room for some mercenaries in some roles? And I was immediately defensive because I was like, well, you know, there's room for you know, what about contractors? What about people who are, just doing small jobs part-time? And he's totally right. There's benefits to being a missionary in all of those jobs. And I had just taken some shortcuts, and it took me processing, just thinking, why did I react so strongly to that conversation?
Yeah, and that's fair. If somebody came to me and kind of poked right on one of my wounds, I would react that way. Or somebody poked on something, a strongly held conviction. But the ultimate thing is, we are smarter when we're together. You know, if you've ever read anything by Jonathan Haidt, he talks about how, you know, individually we're not that smart. In a group, we can be way smarter. The way that we actually get less smart in a group is if we're surrounded by people who all have the same opinion as we do. So if we all come to it with really strong, and we're all from the same background with the same beliefs, we're probably not going to be better as a group. We're probably actually going to be more siloed and insular than we would, or just similarly siloed and insular as we would be alone. But if we can get a group together with different backgrounds, different perspectives, and we can all hear one another out, I'm all for going a different direction. I just want to know, what are we trying to accomplish in that direction? How will we know if it's not working, and how will we know if it is working? Then we can give it a shot. And we can probably constrain it down to a period of time where it doesn't have to risk the business in order to do it.
Right. So those questions were, how do we know it is working, and how do we know it isn't working? Or was there a third one there?
Yeah, how do we know it's working? How will we know if it's working or isn't working? Kind of the same thing. It's like, what bar are we measuring? Yeah, and how can we constrain this to a certain timeline that we can figure that out in a short period of time without giving it too little time, right? And that's not easy, but we can all come together and say, we all agree that this is enough time and this is a good measure. And if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. And, you know, some things will work and they'll just be random. That's why this business is so hard, is we won't even have enough data to know if something worked or not. I don't have the answer to that. I don't feel like that's my specialty. But together with a group of folks around me, we can all help one another see the best route.
What is nonviolent communication?
Yeah, nonviolent communication is a communication method developed by Marshall Rosenberg, a doctor, PhD, who is all about helping us communicate in more compassionate and empathic ways. It's basically communication that tries to minimize hurt and harm. So the idea is, violent communication would be something that causes hurt and harm, and nonviolent communication is something that tries to avoid causing hurt and harm. And Rosenberg argues that a lot of violent communication is actually not very clear communication. There's not a lot of clarity to it. An example of violent communication would be a judgment. Wes, you know, you're not good enough for this team isn't very clear. I'm not really telling you what I base that on. But if I say, hey, Wes, four different times this week, you have been behind schedule on deadlines that you committed to hitting. I'm frustrated. I value consistency. What's going on? Well, now I'm being much clearer than saying, hey, Wes, you're not doing a very good job for this team, or you're not a good team player.
I like that. Do you mind diving into that example with me? So let's say you're my engineering manager. I'm newer on the team. I've got a story I'm working on. And every day in stand up, last couple of days, I've said, it's going to be done today, and it hasn't been, and you want to talk to me about it. How would we use nonviolent communication to kind of structure that conversation? You said no judgment is part of it.
Yeah, it's trying to separate kind of how you feel about a situation from what actually occurred. So I can be frustrated that you've been delayed. Let's say you've done it the last 3 days, where you said you're going to get something done and you didn't do it. Well, my observation, which is just a concrete fact, would be to say, hey, Wes, for the past 3 days, you've said that you were going to finish something and you have not done so. To your own admission, I'm frustrated that that happened. So the thing that happened is you 3 times you've missed the deadline. My feeling about it is frustration. And then I'm going to tell you what I need, because we're teammates. And I'm going to say that I value consistency and communication. And I'm going to tell you I value those things because I don't feel consistency or good communication here. You're communicating things that aren't happening, and you're consistently missing deadlines, which is inconsistent contributions. And then I'm going to ask you, you know, what's going on? And I'm going to let you explain, and I can make a request to you that says, if you're going to tell me that you're going to be done today, be done today. And if you're not going to tell me, please let me know before the next day that it didn't happen. And that's my request. So it's observations, and then it's feelings, and then it's needs and requests. Observation is it happened 3 times. Feeling is I'm frustrated. My needs are consistency and communication. My request is something that is a specific time and place and person doing a specific thing that you can either agree to or not agree to. I'm not allowed to coerce you into that. I'm not allowed to intimidate you into that. You have to want to do it if it's going to be a genuine request. And then you can, you know, also tell me how you feel or what you've observed and what you feel and what you need. And we can see if we can come to some good common ground in an empathetic and compassionate way.
So at the end, the fourth step was getting agreement and not being coerced in agreement, which I think is an important point. Why are agreements important?
Rosenberg would call them requests, but I would say, you know, it's the same thing. An agreement and a request are very similar. We're negotiating a shared course of action. Agreements are super important because we tend to walk around with these unspoken expectations in our heads about what should happen and how people should behave. And I don't know about you, but I don't want to be held to unspoken expectations that I never agreed to. What I'd prefer is you coming to me and saying, hey, Max, here's something that's been on my mind, or here's something I could use your help with, or here's something that I need you to do, laying that out for me and then allowing me to come in and say, well, here's what I actually can do. And it could be the whole thing, or it could be part of the thing, or it could be kind of some deviation or modulation of whatever you need. And you and I coming to a shared course of action that says, here's my part in our agreement. Here's your part of the agreement. Here's when we're going to come and deliver our parts of the agreement, you know, all down the line. It's just clarity. That's helpful because it shows a tremendous amount of respect for you and me. You know, when we're respecting people, we don't hold them to unspoken expectations. We make things clear. And then if they don't live up to that clarity that they've agreed to live up to, we can have a conversation about being frustrated or disappointed, but only then. Otherwise, it's our responsibility to get on the same page and talk about it, about what that same page looks like, and then we move forward. And what's cool about that is if we achieve the goal, we can celebrate together because we are both on the same page about what the goal was. And if we don't achieve the goal, we're clear about where the ball was dropped or what happened that allowed us, that caused us not to achieve the goal. And I argue in chapter 7, which is called Get More Agreements, that no matter who drops the agreement, it's your responsibility to own it. And I think a lot of times, even if we do get agreements, the easiest thing to do is say, well, you know, let's say you and I have an agreement and I just say, you know, well, Wes didn't hold up his end of the agreement. And then I kind of throw the whole thing out. It's just not, that's not teamwork. That's not how I would want somebody to behave if I drop my end of the agreement. So that's not how I'm going to behave if you drop your end of the agreement.
I'd love to hear about some agreements that you've used whenever you're interacting with the engineering team and the product team. Have you found any particular styles of agreements to help you work better?
Yeah, it's a trial and error thing. You know, each agreement has a certain level of clarity that is required. If this is a longer term multi-step agreement, super important that we lay out those steps and we document them. If it's a quick agreement of I'll call that person so you don't have to, probably not as important that we kind of write that out. But the main thing that I'd recommend in an agreement that has any kind of that needs to last and stand the test of time is I write what I heard so you can verify that I got it right. And I can verify that I got it right. And now we have an artifact, because your mind and my mind and everybody else's mind distorts reality over time. And I'm not saying it does it on purpose or for any malicious intent, but we shorten memories, we change memories, we know this to be a fact. So if you and I don't take the time to document something, you know, it might sound really rigid, but it's really thoughtful because it ensures that you and I will both remain aligned as our brains warp and change things.
In our example of I was saying I was going to get something done and stand up, and then the next day it would happen and it wasn't done. I think your agreement was great. A common agreement I might hear is you agreed to keep me updated. What's missing from an agreement like keep me updated?
What does it mean to keep you updated? That is an ambiguous term, keep me updated. My definition is going to be different than yours, more than likely. So we should be clear about what keeping me updated means. You know, if it's an hourly check-in, that might sound onerous, but that might be one example of what you mean by keep me updated. We'd have to come to a conclusion on that, and we can do that by communicating.
What's the quote? The illusion that communication occurred is the biggest problem in communication.
Yeah, it is the illusion. You're right, man. You're right. I mean, think about it like this. It's so easy. If I say that Connor and Megan and Brian are working on something and they're going to let you know when it's done. Well, as soon as I say they're, you don't know if I'm talking about Connor, Megan, or Brian, who's going to let me know if it's done. Are they all going to do it? Pronouns can make it tough. So when I'm writing out sentences, what I try to do, and this is just me being kind of just trying to be as clear as I possibly can be as often as I can be, is just saying Megan's going to let you know when it's done, or Connor's going to let you know when it's done, instead of saying they, because that stuff, that even that little bit of ambiguity can hurt a conversation. I'm not arguing everybody needs to do that, because I don't want people to kind of quit on clarity before they even start. I want you to just try to 1% at a time be clearer and not try to take on this whole big amount of things that need to change in your behavior if you're going to be, as close to crystal clear as you can be. Let's just start by being 1% at a time clearer. And we can do that in small ways, like getting more agreements, like sharing before already, like asking clarifying questions. All the book is about, clarity and camaraderie, but I don't want anybody to kind of summarily shut down and say, well, I'm never going to be able to get there by trying to take it all on at once.
Scaling Software Teams is brought to you by my startup, Woven. After Max's team at Lessonly raised their Series B round of funding, they needed to scale their engineering team. Woven owns the top of Lessonly's hiring funnel, running every candidate through a one-hour technical work simulation. Every candidate gets detailed, actionable feedback because candidate experience matters. Whether they get the job or not, every applicant gets the opportunity, to borrow a phrase from Max, to do better work. Lessonly's head of engineering told us about one of his recent hires. Without Woven, I would have definitely passed on this candidate. This was absolutely Woven's value prop being proven out. At Woven, the first thing we do with our customers is 3 to 5x their inbound candidate volume. We just took a customer from 5 to 60 candidates per week. It's not magic, it's just a checklist of things that make a big difference in job board marketing. Today, I'm offering that consultation for free to listeners of our podcast. You can go to woventeams.com/free to schedule with me. Again, if you want to 3x your inbound candidate flow, go to woventeams.com/free.
What is anti-fragility and how does that relate to difficult conversations on a team?
Yeah, so anti-fragility is this idea that some things gain from stress and disorder and chaos. And Nassim Taleb is a gentleman who coined the term. And he coined the term because he thought he realized we don't really have a word for things that gain from stress and disorder and chaos. But many things do. Our muscles or some of our systems gain from stress and order and chaos. Our teams gain from stress and order and chaos. They do so by learning. You don't learn a lot in a situation where everything goes to plan, but you can learn a ton when certain functions break down. And what you can learn in that is, well, why did they break down? How can we avoid it next time? You can build strength by having things not go the way you want and then learning from that situation. When I talk about anti-fragility in the book, I talk about it as anti-fragile relationships. So I think we tend to look at our relationships as really fragile, and that's one of the reasons why we don't talk about conflict when we feel it, because we worry it's going to damage the relationship. The reality is we will damage the relationship if we argue our way through it and we judge our way through it and villainize people. There's a lot of ways you could ruin a relationship in the midst of conflict, and a lot of it has to do with violently communicating. But if we choose to non-violently communicate through our conflict, we can actually understand one another better. We can grow and learn with one another. And when we do that, we strengthen our relationship over time. So we use the chaos, we use the stress, and we turn it into something that is positive. And Nassim Taleb argues that chronic stress is not what we're after here. We're trying to make sure things there's acute stress and we learn from that acute stress. You don't want chronic stress. Chronic stress will kill you, but you do want acute stress because acute stress can help you grow. And an example would be
what's the difference between chronic and acute stress, in case we have any non-medical folks?
Yeah. So if I'm going out and lifting a weight, let's say I'm going to go out and bench press today. If I repeatedly lift that weight, never give my body time to kind of take a break and rebuild the muscle that I broke down, I'm going to put chronic stress on the muscle. I'm overusing it to the point that it actually starts to atrophy and almost sicken. And I can't tell you all the medical reasons. I think there's lactic acid in there. That's one of the issues. But when we do acute stress in the same weightlifting analogy, I would lift and then I'd rest. And that rest period allows the stress that I put on my muscles to grow back and become stronger. That acute stress was momentary. Chronic stress is long-term and continuous.
I want to tie that chronic versus acute, because I think that's so important. Back to, let's say that first conversation, that a developer that is not updating their manager on progress. So can we think, like, what would be a... What's a chronic version of that, and what would be an acute version?
Yeah, so acute version is it ends. You figure out how to communicate better if you're the developer about where you're at and set better expectations and you know, whatever our communication is along the way that the checking in starts to happen. So the behavior changes based on the stressful 3 days where the way that you were communicating about what was going to happen and it didn't happen. You know that
so
changes
we have that
it for the better. Yeah. 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 We hit it head on. Chronic stress is I'm frustrated with you as the developer and I don't talk to you about it. I allow it to continue, or I do talk to you about it and it continues anyway. That would create chronic stress. So it's ongoing. It's over time. Whereas, you know, the more acute stress would it be happen in a smaller group of time. And we benefit from having had it happen in the first place, because now we understand one another better.
My guest today has been Max Yoder. Max, thank you for being on Scaling Software Teams.
It was my pleasure. Thank you, Wes.
Thanks again to Max for sharing his experience with us. Here are a few takeaways I had from our conversation. Number one, vulnerability enables exception handling. Software that silently swallows errors is bad. Suppressing those small errors causes bigger problems to pop up later when they're harder to solve. Errors are important information. As leaders, when we hide our mistakes and our risks, we're hiding information. When we demonstrate vulnerability with our teams, they'll do the same. That enables efficient information flow and better teams. Number two, share before you're ready. In the product world, we've learned that getting MVPs in front of users reduces the risk of us building the wrong thing. That same principle can be applied everywhere on our teams. Sharing a one-hour version of an idea for feedback reduces waste. We want the Venn diagram of what's getting done and what's needed to be a circle. We must create a cultural norm around early sharing of low-fidelity ideas. Number three, leaders don't know the answer. Leaders learn the answer. It's really easy to fall into the trap of knowing the answer. If we model a know-it-all behavior and culture, our teams will do the same thing. That shuts off new and better ideas. High-growth software teams are fundamentally hard. We don't know the answer. Our job is to learn the answer. Thanks again to Max for coming on the show. Now I want to hear from you. Should we cover more books on the show? Was the role play useful? Tweet me at Wes Winham. Thanks, and I'll talk to you next week.